Okay, so let's start. Last class we started talking about microarrays.
Okay, we started talking about the biology of microarrays, the biology or chemistry of microarrays, and why it's sort of an exciting thing. Are there any questions, first of all, about anything we talked about last class? You know, how you make microarrays, why they're exciting things. Okay. How many people here went to the Affymetrix presentation? We had an Affymetrix presentation earlier today. I saw a bunch of people from the class. In fact, I think some people from the class are still, I had to leave early, so I think some people are there. There were a couple people, here they were. It was a very interesting presentation by Affymetrix, the company that makes these microarrays. We passed one out last time. Okay, this is sort of an example of a chip that has, you know, several hundred thousand, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of probes on it, okay, that are basically all of the nucleotide sequences, DNA sequences. And you can tell whether that sequence is present or absent, okay, in a particular target sample using one of these things, okay? And again, it's a big enough business, they even have silly promotional items. This is a chocolate chip, okay? As you'll notice, it's the same size as and shape as one of their real chips, but doesn't work as well in their machines. But the one thing that I thought was very, very interesting is one other application that came out of their, out of their presentation that I think is very exciting that I want to mention just as sort of as the application. It's an important application of biology and arrays that that I wouldn't otherwise have discussed this semester, but it's kind of a very an interesting idea. And it has to do with this notion of linkage analysis. Okay? We sort of have this idea so far. All we know about biology is what we discussed in this class. We have this idea that there are genes. These genes code for proteins. Okay? And we know that different people have slightly different versions of genes. They inherit from their parents. Okay? That, you know, there are these SNPs, these common substitutions that occur. So that there's a certain amount of variability. Everyone in the room has the same gross set of genes, but people have different flavors. A flavor of a gene would be called an allele, okay, is the way you would describe it, depending upon exactly what the composition is. Okay, and of course, there's variation that even goes outside of genes, okay? And that you're inheriting some things from one parent, some things from another parent. And depending upon what you inherit, you know, there's a great deal of disease potential. You know, a lot of diseases have genetic components to it. I mean, that you inherit diseases from your parents. Okay? And so one of the problems that is probably one of the more important problems in medicine is given in a world where we have 40,000 genes in the human or something like that, and you know there's a certain genetic disease. Okay, let's say muscular dystrophy is a genetic disease, or Huntington's disease, the famous genetic disease. Which of these 40,000 genes causes that disease? Okay, well, let's say breast cancer is a very famous example. There are certain genes that are linked to breast cancer, okay, and that you would like to try to figure out which gene is responsible for breast cancer, because that's important for diagnosis, it's important for cures. How can you find out which gene is linked, causes a particular disease? Okay? So now we need to do something that's a little different than anything we've done before, which is make a link between medical data and genetic data. Okay? Everybody see that that's sort of now the right thing of what these things are doing. You need to make some kind of a link there. Okay? Any ideas how you might do that? Okay? Yeah. So now you're saying in a microarray era, we can look at the healthy people and the normal people, but we'll look at the expression of how much for each of their genes was there. Okay? And look at the difference in normal and healthy people. That's true, but the fact that you inherit things from your parents doesn't seem to be recorded anywhere here. Okay, so you might say, well, look, here's a gene that in healthy people is high and in diseased people is low in that particular tissue sample. But that doesn't exploit any information about what you inherit from your parents, okay? And that seems like an important component. So especially in an inherited disease, if you think about it, the interesting property is that you're inheriting it from your parents. So how can you make a link between a disease, a phenotype, let's say, as we would call it, and where on the genetic material that disease problem is? And historically, this was done by a very computationally and mathematically intensive way called method of linkage analysis. Okay, and the basic observation is the following: that for any particular chromosome, you have two versions. In general, you have two versions of this chromosome: one you inherited from your mother, and one you inherited from your father. The version you got from your father. Okay, your father had two versions. Let's say this is the chromosome 5. You got a chromosome 5 from your mother and a chromosome 5 from your father. Okay? How did you get that? Where did that chromosome 5 from your father come from? Well, it came from the genetic material that he had from chromosome 5, which was what? Okay, a chromosome 5 from your grandfather. And a chromosome 5 from your grandmother. Okay? And somehow these two chromosomes have to be combined into one. You're only getting one. You're getting a total of 46 chromosomes, 23 from each parent. Each parent has 46. How does it go and how do you get one of them from your parents? Okay? You believe the number, simple probability, you might simply pick one at random. But that's not what happens, okay, this basically. What you get is a combination of what you get from your parents, okay? So in fact, the chromosome that you're going to inherit, if this is your grandfather's chromosome, and this is your grandmother's chromosome, what basically happens is that there is a random process that walks along and takes runs from each one of the grandparents. So there's this recombination phase where you're getting large chunks from one, and then every once in a while you randomly switch over to the other grandparents and randomly switch over back to the other grandparent. Okay? And what you're getting then, inheriting then, is half of the genetic material your father had from his grandparents. Okay? And it represents random chunks here. Okay? Does everybody see that? Or believe that. Any questions about this process? So this process explains a couple of things. It explains, for example, why all the children of a particular parent don't look the same. Okay? Because you're getting the random switching back and forth is, it's random. Every time you produce a new, sperm or egg cell, you're jumping back and forth in a different way. Okay? So that's where you get the random variance. But it also has some other implications. It tells me that if I got a particular gene here, if I inherited this gene from my grandfather, is it reasonably likely that the neighboring gene on the chromosome I also get from my grandfather? Okay? The answer is I will, unless there was this sort of crossover event happening between the two genes. Okay? Does everybody sort of believe that? Okay? So, there is somehow this linkage that geographically, the probability that you got, if this cell gene came from your grandfather, if you walk along the, depending upon the genomic distance from that gene, the probability that you inherit this other neighboring genes from your grandparents is going to be, it's going to decrease as a function of distance. Okay, originally fairly high, and far enough away it's going to be 50-50. Okay, there's a certain number of jumps, crossovers back and forth. I will say on the order of, let's say, 10 per chromosome or something like that. Okay? So, you get this, there's this geographic component that you would like to know that's important to try to figure out if you have diseases. Okay? So suppose we have a little family tree here, where you have somebody who has a disease, and they have two children, one of whom is healthy, what are symptoms of disease. Okay? How am I going to figure out roughly where that gene is that causes that disease? Okay? If we knew that your parents here, okay, if we look at your parents' chromosome, okay, and we look at the healthy kid and the genetic kid, you'll have to look at your mom. Okay, remember, some of this is coming from mom and some of this is coming from dad. Okay? You would like to figure out what regions of the chromosome did you inherit from the prospective parent. And what did you inherit? Okay, from them. Again, it's this is child one, this is child two. It's going to inherit a slightly different set of regions. And if you can figure out exactly what regions you got from which grandparent, and you knew the health or, you knew whether that particular grandparent had a disease or not, didn't have a disease, you could go back and do the analysis to try to figure out what portions did you inherit from the defective, where did you get that disease from, okay? If you know that you came from a defective parent, okay, and this is what you got from the defective parent, then it is probably from here, okay? So everybody sort of get that idea. And there's sort of this idea that the more information you can figure out about what DNA, where did these crossovers occur, in what you inherited from the parent, the better off you are. The higher resolution you can place where that defective gene might be. Okay, any questions about that? So there is this, historically though, you can't get very much information about what you inherit from which parent. You know, for example, you know about eye color without doing a DNA study. I know you've got a hair color, I know you've got an eye color, I know there's other features that you can observe about me, you might have inherited from a parent. That tells me something about what genes you got from home. You can do other sort of experiments to try to figure out what genes did you get from home. But the new and the future way of doing it would be, what if we could build a single microarray that would have a probe every 10,000 bases or less. So that you would know turned out based on variants, did you get this, is this SNP, this location that I have, the same that I got from one parent or from the other parent, okay? And so I later that if you have an array that will do this SNP detection on a large scale across the chromosome, you can figure out what regions did you inherit from whom, okay? And this then enables you potentially to do a much better job tracking down diseases. Any questions about that? Basic biology of that, or basic logic of that. Okay? Yes?
Can the crossover split genes?
So the question, can the crossover split genes? The answer is potentially yes. There's nothing that really prevents it. But a couple of things guard against make that unlikely. What makes it unlikely that crossovers will split genes? Anybody think of why that would be unlikely? Relatively unlikely? Yeah? Well, genes are relatively, you've got a lot of junk, and you've got relatively small numbers of genes, right? So the amount of stuff, if you're having picking 10 random bullets to shoot, okay, odds are you're not going to hit between the genes, right? You're going to go instead, so most of the combination is taking whole genes. Okay? Second, if you go between an intron, it probably doesn't make too much difference because that's still relative junk. So you could split genes. It's more likely that might cause problems and the fetus might not work. It might cause a lethal problem. But if so, then that pregnancy doesn't work. Okay? So the answer is you can, but what are the advantages of having all this junk? Is that it makes it more likely that when you do a crossover, it only shuffles genes rather than, work within each gene. Yeah.
In any way, in principle, problem?
In principle, it's not a problem.
Okay. Actually, more compact genes like the.
Right. So.
Insects.
Right. So some of the lower some organisms like yeast do have something that's some form of sexual reproduction. Okay. Where you do have this kind of crossover and stuff happening. Yeasts have much more compact genomes. On the other hand, yeasts also have a much shorter cycle time. So things break in a yeast. It's not quite yellow. So you have, if I understand it, you know, yeasts will split or reproduce every couple of hours.
Yeah, but recognition will happen normally in the meiosis. So they reproduce, you know, the normal cell cycle within the meiosis.
Right.
But then when they have this crossover,
how often does that happen? In principle, you should split genes. Okay, that's certainly nothing. In principle, there's nothing with this theory that says you can't split genes. But what is clear, one consequence to having a lot of junk DNA and relatively small numbers of crossovers is that you will split genes relatively infrequently. Okay.
Is that what the genes are?
No, it is red. I mean, you sometimes hear stories and there are hot spots where things cross over more likely or less likely than others. But in principle, it's a vaguely random, it's a basically random process, yes.
Why does this split
in the human mind? Are there synchronies on the strand of genes? So the answer is basically right. This crossover is working. There is this synchronization. So you are not going to be adding genes or, you know, so basically, they're basically in sync, okay? Not perfectly in sync, but basically in sync, okay? So you're unlikely to lose a gene in this process, okay? Or gain two copies of the same gene, okay?
Are the genes
exactly the same as the exact mechanics of how this happened are a little bit mysterious to me, okay? But I will imagine that it has something to do with sort of some kind of hybridization, and there's sort of large chunks that are sort of being transferred back and forth. So, I mean, it's not the case that they have to be, it's not a perfect thing, you know. You may have more, there are these, there's some variability of inserted sites between genomes. So the genome, the odds of the genome length of your parents are exactly to the same number of bases as long as each other. And they're not going to be exactly as long as each other. So you can't have a base-for-base copy, okay? But there are presumably synchronization points and things like that. So that the system works reliably. Okay? Yes?
My question was, type of gene, we know that this is a gene will be on this chromosome, the location around 4,000,
right.
4,000, 4,000, right. Can be a variant.
Well, the answer is it can be some variants, because remember, there are these, remember we talked about O.J. Simpson and how we were going to identify O.J. Simpson by how many repeats there were at certain points in his genome? So the answer there is a certain amount of variation, so some jumps, some repetitions, some transposons that may or may not have gotten in there. So there's going to be a certain amount of variance from people to people. So it's not exactly the 976,546 base. It's not going to be the start of a gene in every person. There's going to be a certain amount of variance, but not enough to gum up this work. Is that basically true?
Yeah, I think so. But the recombination won't happen in position 4,000 and 4,000. It will happen in the position where the two strands pair. So, you know, so it will pair gene to gene or intergene region with a intergene region. You know what I mean? So it won't happen. I have the impression
that you're thinking that if it happens in position 4,000 and 4,000, then you get to everything comes out.
So I think basically what he's saying is the recombination is based on this sort of a hybridization going on between the two sides. And so what's probably going to happen is that regions of great similarity are going to bind. There might be bubbles here. Let's say where there is some kind of a difference. There's going to be some bubble that's going to stick out here. And that's not going to be very important. Okay? And so this might be, may get spliced out or it may get, something's going to happen. But basically, it's going to rely on the fact that
come and read that, that regions of high similarity are going to bind with each other, and that's what brings these things together. Okay? Any questions? Okay? But the important point is this idea that suddenly now you could use one of these SNP arrays, okay, or one of these linkage arrays, to figure out exactly what you got from each parent. Okay? Seems to me to be a very exciting thing. And, you know, potentially when it comes to sort of trying to map diseases to genes, it's potentially an extremely powerful thing. Okay? Any other questions? Okay? Yeah. What is SBH? Okay. So, any other, SBH is the topic of today's lecture. So, it's going to be sequencing by hybridization. But I wanted to want to add this digression. Any other comments or so from some people went to the talk I know just came in? Any other things from the talk that seem mysterious or interesting from the SBH talk? Okay. Anyway, just to say. Okay. So what I would like to talk about now is now everybody should have an idea that we can build these probes, these arrays of probes, and that we can do a lot of biologically useful things with them. That is what you should carry away with. And that the number of things that you can do with these things is limited by basically your ideas, okay? So what the original vision of these arrays, okay, had to do with some kind of an idea called sequencing by hybridization, okay? So we've talked a little bit about the idea that you can use arrays for resequencing things. The original idea of where this whole array technology came from was, as far as I can tell, not really to measure gene expression, not really to resequence variants. The original interest was provoked largely by the mathematical community, okay, on trying to use these arrays of probes for de novo sequencing. Remember, we looked at these gel electrophoresis machines that will read 500 base, you know, you could read 500 bases at a time using one of those sequencing machines. An alternate idea for sequencing, okay, that was, you know, sort of hypothesized largely about the same time, was suppose we could build an array which had a large number of short probes in it, okay? Let's say all probes of size, all possible sequences of size 11, okay? We hybridize the target sequence that we want, something, a piece of DNA we want to sequence, okay? Against this array, and we then sequence this unknown target by basically figuring out which subsequences, using the probes to tell us which subsequences on the array were and were not present. Okay? So, for example, I mean, the basic idea might be, suppose, let's say, I gave you a string of all tumors, strings of length 2. Okay? Let's say I want to sequence the A, C, T, T, G. Let's say that I have this unknown molecule I want to sequence. Okay? I don't know anything about it, let's say. But suppose I could ask questions of the form for all possible pairs of bases, all possible oligos of length 2, all possible tumors. Which tumors were present in this unknown sequence? Okay? Well, which ones are? There's AT, there is TT, and there is TG. Okay? How many possible strings of length, sequences of length 2 are there? Okay? 4 by 4 is 16. 3 of those 16 would, on my very simplified array, light up. Could I, based on these, knowing that these 3 and these 3 only were present, could I go back and figure out what the sequence, unknown sequence, was? Okay? Any ideas how you might go about it? Question is, now I give you as input that all the tumors in my string, okay, see, unknown sequence for this, could you go back and figure out what the sequence had to be? Okay? How might you do that? What might the sequence be? Yeah? Well, you could use overlapping. That's what we did before. You could say A, T, 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 C, G. Okay? That's sort of like we did before by using the overlap window. But we have more information here. Okay? How do we know that the sequence is not G-A-T-T-G? Okay? How do we know that this is not the correct sequence? Okay? What? Because if it had been the case, I would have seen the tumor GA in my sample. So the thing that is powerful here, potentially, is not when we do shotgun sequencing. We're learning the presence of a lot of strains, saying, hey, this strain is present in the target. When you do one of these array analyses, in principle, you're learning something more. You're learning not only what strains are present, but you're also learning for whatever probes didn't light up, what strains are not present. Does everybody see that? Okay? So potentially this is a more powerful thing, and algorithmically a different thing than just doing the sort of shortest common strain. Does everybody agree with that? What is the algorithmic problem? Basically, you want the shortest string that contains all of these and none of the things that aren't supposed to be there. Does everybody see that? Okay? That makes this algorithmically a very different problem, and as you will see, an amazingly beautiful problem. Okay? One reason why the mathematicians are very excited about this. Any questions? With this particular sequence, though, are there any other strains that are consistent with it? I said that we had these tumors. I told you they were present.
Yeah.
Is there any other strain that's present with it?
Yeah, not some repeats.
What is it?
Repeats.
Repeats? What kind of repeats? A, T, 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 G would also be a sequence. Does everybody see that? That if all I know that it's present, AT is present, T, 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 T. There is no way that this experiment is sufficient to distinguish certain kinds of repeats from it. Okay, but there's going to be some limitations. The question really is, how do we figure out when a sequence is uniquely expressed, or what sequences are represented by these arrays? Any questions? Okay? So this is why, by SPH, what we mean is this notion of sequencing by hybridization. Namely, using an array of short probes and yes and no answers to determine what the sequence is. Okay? So that is the vision. What is the reality? Well, the reality is not quite there, actually. Okay? But it's, you know, that we agree that basically what I've said before, that today, arrays are used for sequencing, but they're mostly used for resequencing. Okay? I told you the idea that you design a custom chip to sequence variants of arrays. So let's say you would build a array for HIV that would find all the variations. So here you already know one version of the sequence, and you want to capture all kind of variants of it. So this is something that is actually used, and as we discussed before, it's used. We discussed the architecture of these chips. Typically, you would create a probe for every 25 mer in the array, and then actually you construct four possible probes. Okay, and we would change the middle base of the array. We'd have four probes, one with every possible base in that 13th position. And the assumption is that the real one that is present in the target will hybridize more strongly to it. Okay? So certainly, SPH is now used for resequencing. Okay? However, SPH for de novo sequencing has never quite been put to practice. Okay? For a variety of technical reasons. Okay? But it's still an incredibly interesting idea, and it's one of these ideas that never completely dies. Okay? So I'd like to spend today talking about sort of the theory of SPH, okay? Because it's very interesting. It's one of these ideas that never quite goes away, okay? And one of the things that we learned with the Affymetrics talk today is, of course, these arrays are getting denser and denser. And the question of why SPH isn't used is more an economic, is partially an economic question. And if you get arrays with enough probes on this technology might well come back. Okay? Any questions? Okay, so the question we really want to look at here is how do we use SBH for de novo sequencing, where we don't know anything about our target, okay, and we want to figure out what, except which tamers are there, okay, what the answers to the probes in our target is. How good a job you can do for sequencing depends a lot upon the design of your array. We think about these affymetrics arrays.
Okay, we can design probes that can do anything we want, right, up to length 25. Now, so if you wanted to, so one interesting question is, what would be the best design of an array that would give you somehow the most information about a sequence? If you don't know anything about the sequence, the most obvious initial array might be to construct an array of all 4 to the k probes. Okay? Where k is sort of a constant of length, let's say 10, 8, 9, 11, something that's a function of the size of your chip. Okay? So instead of building an array of all 4 to the 8 probes, how much is 4 to the 8? Okay? 64,000, 65,000 or so. Okay? So you can build easily an array of all 8 probes. Today, they would talk about having 500,000 probes on a chip. How many probes, how big a chamber can you use for 500,000 probes? What? 10, okay? So 4 to the 10 is, 65,000 times 4. What? Okay. Right. 64,000 times 16, which is a little bit more. So 10 verse cannot quite fit on a 500,000 probe chip, but 9 verse can. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So the question really for the day is,
and again, there have been arrays built that have tedmers, although you can't buy them in stores. Okay? Because of these combinatorial constraints, you can't build an array with all 20 mers of DNA, possible 20 mers, because 4 to the 20 is a trillion. Okay? So there is some combinatorial constraint as to how many probes you can put on in a chip. Okay? But the question really is, can we construct how do we reconstruct from one of these classical chip designs, where you ask the question for a particular K, you get the answer back for every chamber, is it present, is it not present? How do you figure out what the sequence is? Any ideas? Okay. Well, one idea of how you might reconstruct, sort of sequence from SBH data would be to build a graph where the vertices of the graph represent the probes that said yes, okay, and we have an edge between any two probes that overlap in all but one position, okay? So here we have a vertex where every probe every probe is a vertex of the graph. And there is an edge if there is an overlap in all but one position. So there's an edge from CAA to AAA because the last two characters of this equals the first character of this. There's a probe from AAA to itself, okay? And so if we have this graph, what kind of sequences, how can we describe what the sequences are that are consistent with this? Okay. So now build a graph where the vertices are the probes. Okay. There is an edge between every, allowable overlap of one base. How can I figure out an overlap of all but one base? From such a graph, is it possible in principle to determine which sequences are consistent with the data? Okay, what would be a DNA sequence? Yes?
You should be able to tell us all the known sequences from
It's important that I visit every single node in the graph. Why is that? Because every node in the graph is a probe that lit up, right? Okay? So basically what I want is, the set of sequences that are consistent with this data are exactly equal to the S that visit every single node in the graph. Okay? Does everybody agree with that? Now, the hope would be that it's somewhat unique. Okay, if you want to claim to get the sequence from a graph like this, you would like to get that, it would be important that somehow your path be unique. Okay? So the presence of an edge like this, in principle, causes problems, right? A self-loop like this. Because an arbitrary number of loops through that would be trouble. Okay? But at the very least, you might hope to reconstruct large chunks of sequence, okay, with certain ambiguities here. Certain, from one of these experiments, you might very well get a lot of information about the sequence from this path structure. Any questions? Okay? Yes? Why does, which one? Why does CAA go to ACA? That's because I've made this one. Why does this go to this? Why does it not go to ACA? The reason is because I made a mistake. No. Wait. CAA should not go to ACA. But ACA should go to CAA. Okay, does everybody agree? We're going to have the edges should go from A to B. If you can add a character to the string of A and then have B as a suffix, that is the consideration. Which one should have not have done? CAA should not have gone to ACG. Yes, you're 100% right. So really what should happen is this edge, I think, should go, and this edge should come in. Okay? And so we can attribute this to experimental error, or the error of the guy making the slide. Okay? Any questions? Okay, so the problem really is, how do we find a Hamilton, how do we find a path visiting every vertex in the graph? What problem is that algorithmically? Okay, so one problem is to find the start node, okay? What you really want to do is to find a path that visits every vertex, so maybe they tell you in certain experiments, maybe you could learn the start node, okay, or maybe not. Okay, you still want to know, maybe even learn the length of the sequence to help you disambiguate it. But the basic reconstruction question would seemingly be the Hamiltonian path problem. What is the Hamiltonian path problem? This is sort of like the traveling salesman problem. You want to visit every vertex in a graph such that, you want to find the shortest tour or the existence of a tour that visits every path, vertex in the path exactly once. Okay? That's sort of the classical problem that we need to solve. Okay? The problem, of course, is that Hamiltonian path, as we've seen so far, is an NP-complete problem. Another problem is that if there's multiple paths, in principle, the sequence is not uniquely defined. Okay? Does everybody agree with that? Okay? So we have to deal with that. The other thing is that if we want it to be uniquely defined, we must have a K large enough to, span those kind of repeats. Okay? Okay? But one thing that's nice about this Hamiltonian path problem is that we can, in principle, adapt it to error. Okay? We know that there's errors in these hybridizations. When we get a probe, we don't really necessarily know what the, you get yes or no, but there's a certain probability of error, okay, because you're doing any kind of an experiment. Did this hot probe hybridize? By using a sort of a Hamiltonian / traveling salesman kind of approach, you can in principle assign a weight to an edge being the probability, a weight to a vertex, the probability that it really is there. You can assign the weight of the edge to the as a function of the probability that this is here and this is here. By playing these kind of games, you can hope to overcome errors and things like that. Okay? So everybody see in principle how this kind of a reconstruction problem reduces to a traveling salesman Hamiltonian circuit type problem. Any questions? Yes. You want to try to reconstruct what the most likely sequence is, given this kind of an experiment. Okay, given the data from this experiment. These triplets you are given as a result of the arrays, okay, you were given an array. You learned exactly what k-mers were, what k-mers were present, in this case k equals 3, and what k-mers were not present. Based on that, okay, you could build this graph. And now you want to find what is the best path through this graph that visits all the vertices, that visits all the vertices and best explains, thus explains the data. So what is it? What is in this path? Let's say the shortest possible sequence. Suppose my graph was right here. What would be the shortest possible sequence that would contain all the that would be consistent with this data? Okay, I claim it's unique actually. Start with here. I could walk to here, walk to here, walk to here. I'm visiting every k-mer exactly once, right? So if we believe that the shortest sequence is the most likely, the best explanation, then looking for the shortest path that visits every single one of these would be the best explanation. Okay? We might have other paths that we say have certain criteria. Okay? But in principle, it now becomes a problem of analyzing paths on graphs. And notice that we actually can read the sequence off once we have the path on the graph. Right? The path on the graph, what is the sequence going to be? It's A, C, G, C, A, C, A, C, T, T, A. Notice we walk, the act of walking from one vertex to another tells us one more base in our sequence. Okay? Any questions? Okay? Yes? So cycles represent, in principle, a certain amount of ambiguity in the graph.
Actually, there's a cycle.
So there are a couple of cycles here. What are the cycles? Well, there's one cycle here. Where is there another cycle? Well, here is another cycle. In the originally drawn graph, there would not be a cycle. Then there's another one here. Okay? Cycles represent ambiguity. Does everybody agree with that? Okay? If you want to know all sequences that are consistent with it. Okay? But the claim would be that by analyzing these graphs, you can identify here, for example, at least for this part of the sequence, there is no ambiguity. Okay? So there's regions of some ambiguity linked by regions of, of no ambiguity linked by regions of ambiguity. Yeah. Okay, so now you're starting to get into why mathematicians find this a very interesting technology. You want to now start playing games with what other experimental data could you use to disambiguate it? How do you design the best possible array for this thing? What is the power of this? How much sequence can you hope to reconstruct on average? Stuff like this. So we'll get into variations just like that, okay, a little later. Okay, yes? Well, not the shortest, so the shortest, we don't want the shortest path from start to sink. We want the shortest path that visits every single node. Okay? That then will be, if we find, take a detour like this and don't visit that vertex, then we are not consistent with the experimental data. Okay? In principle, we want the shortest path visiting every vertex, which is exactly what the Hamiltonian path problem asks, right? Okay? And you might argue that, well, why do we want the shortest one? Okay? And that's a less well-defined question. But at least you'd like to know if it is unique. Notice that by deleting a small number of edges from this, namely deleting this edge and deleting this edge and this edge, I think that there's still non-directed cycles in the graph. Okay? But the path becomes unique. Okay. Or bleeding this edge, and if you bleed this edge and this edge, the even though there's still sort of you can bleed it, you can have certain edges in the graft, okay? So that it's not, the graft is not just a path. There can be some complexity in the graft, and the Hamiltonian path still be unique. Okay? Any questions? Yeah. Why did I come up with this in my graph? Well, the reason is if all I know are strings are of length, I'm asking questions of length 3, probes of length 3. If I take a suffix of length 3, the last two characters of A, of AAA, and add an A to it, I get back the same sequence that I had now. So there's a way to extend this by a base that will take it back to me. So this is a self loop in the graph, okay? And it's formed, again, a loop is, an edge is formed by finding two sequences, vertices in the graph, which overlap in all but one position, okay? And if they can be the same vertex, that's perfectly fine. Any questions? Yeah. From which, where am I missing another edge? ACA to what? ACA to what? CAC. You're saying that I should, right, so this should be a two-directional edge, you're right, okay? Any questions? Okay, we agree that, again, so we have to get the graph right, we agree, okay? But what's interesting, okay, so any questions about this basic graph idea and reconstructing sequences from the graph? Okay? In principle, this is not different from the traveling salesman problem. Hamiltonian traveling salesman problem asks you, you're given a set of vertices, you're given a weight between every pair, and you want to find the cheapest path that visits all of them. Yeah, you have to come back to the original one, no. Here we don't really need to have a cycle. So one difference is that we have a path problem instead of a cycle problem. The other problem is, at least as I've described it, every path is of uniform weight. Okay? Although you could play games with that just for experimental conditions and things like that. Any questions? Okay? But the biggest problem that we have here is that these Hamiltonian paths are hard to find in graphs. It's an anti-complete problem. Is there a way we can get rid of make this problem polynomial time, make it efficient? Okay? Even though lurking behind it is a Hamiltonian path. And the answer is by cleverly reformulating our problem. Okay? An Eulerian path in a graph is a path which visits every edge in the graph exactly once. A Hamiltonian cycle path, remember, was visited every vertex once. Okay? So a Hamiltonian path of this complete graph on 5 vertices would be just going from basically any permutation would be a Hamiltonian path. An Eulerian path is something that visits every edge exactly once. Now one place where they arise, you sometimes have a children's puzzle. Given a picture of a picture like this, is there a way to draw it without ever lifting your pen off the paper? Okay? So I now give you, is there a way to draw K5, okay, the complete graph without lifting your pen off the paper?
How would I do it? I might say, boom, 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 and now I'm trapped. No, not trapped. There I still not. Okay? So these are half Eulerian cycles. Okay? Any questions about what an Eulerian cycle is, how it differs from a Hamiltonian cycle? Okay, it visits edges rather than vertices. Now that may not seem like a big difference, except that Eulerian cycles are very easy to find in graphs. Anyone who's taken an elementary CS class, how do you tell if a graph has an Eulerian cycle to it? Okay, if I give you a graph like this, how can you tell whether or not there's a way to draw it without lifting the pen off the paper? Okay, does anyone remember the condition?
that you or you still answer the one thing and is part of that.
Okay. If you want to find an Eulerian cycle, the claim is that so long as the graph is connected and every vertex is of even degree, you can then draw it so that you can lead from one vertex to another and visit all the edges and come back home.
Why is it necessary that the vertices be of even degree? Why do you add another edge, let's say, out here that caused these two vertices to be of odd degree? Why would that now not be possible to have an Eulerian cycle? Okay. Somehow in a cycle you've got to get in the vertex and you got to get out of the vertex without reusing the edge, right? So how are you going to go in and, you know, every time you go in, you go out. You use an edge going in and going out. The act of cruising through a vertex reduces the number of remaining edges you need to do by two. Okay? So if it was even, it has to stay even. Okay? So that's a proof that, in fact, the degrees of the vertices have to be even to have an Eulerian cycle. A little bit more complicated is the question of how do you now prove that if the vertices are even degree, that you, in fact, do have a way of doing that drawing. Okay, any ideas how you would prove that? Okay. So you start from one vertex and you just keep walking. It is not true that any walk on a graph is going to necessarily end up in a, an Eulerian cycle. Why not? Can anyone show me, can we construct an example of a graph where you might make a mistake? Okay. What would be an example of a graph where you might make a mistake? Okay. So let's say, like, okay, so for example, here might be a good example of how you might get into trouble. Okay? Suppose, let's say, you want an Eulerian cycle of this graph. If I just walk in a lazy way, now I'm trapped, right? And I still have edges I didn't cover. Okay? So it is not true that any walk on this graph will give you an Eulerian cycle. How do we find an Eulerian cycle on this graph? Yes. Okay, so the way that I think what you're suggesting is you want to find a cycle in the graph. What if I find any cycle in this graph? Let's say this one. And I now delete it from the graph and find an Eulerian cycle on the remaining thing. Okay? Is there a way I can put the cycle that I have in there back into the Eulerian cycle of the remaining thing to make sure I visit all the other cycles? Okay? Let's say, for example, for my star here, okay, I have a, after I delete this, I'm going to have this following kind of a graph. Is that the graph that's left after I, yeah, after I, this. Okay, after I delete this targeted cycle, I now have a smaller graph which has vertices of degree to even degree, right? I can find an Eulerian cycle on this graph. Once I have that cycle, I'll claim at some point I have to visit some vertex that's adjacent to this cycle. Why is that? The graph was connected before, right? So if I pull out this, a certain number of edges from that graph, at least one of these edges has to touch some vertex that is in the connected part of the remaining graph. If I now find an Eulerian cycle of this,
I can splice in, when you go to here, I'll instead say, wait, take a detour over to my other cycle that I've extracted. And I can insert that other cycle, okay, and make my Eulerian path cycle longer. How many people sort of see that? How many people don't see that and want to see it? It's stupid, you don't see it. Okay? Let's look at the example here. Look at another example. Let's say I want to find an Eulerian cycle of, let's say here is the, what was the Bill Gates house threat, okay, or whatever, it's sort of a house on the side. Okay? Vertices A, B, C, and D, and E. How can I find my Eulerian cycle of this thing? I'm going to first pull off any cycle I want, simple cycle, which you can do by breadth first search or anything like that. Find any cycle and graph in the card. What cycle should I pull off? They don't want a cycle. A, B, C, D. Okay? Now this is gone. But now I have a cycle like this. What other cycle can I now extract? Okay? I can extract A, E, D, back to A, right? Now can I find a common cycle that contains both of them? What if I go from A to E to D to A to B? Okay? Does everybody agree that this is now a cycle that has merged those two cycles? Okay? That has to do this. I had a way of going from D to A. I had a way to go from A to B. I had a way to go from A to E. Right? So these two can be merged at any common vertex to make a bigger cycle. Okay? Does everybody agree with that now? Sort of agree? Any questions? So I claim it's actually easy to find an Eulerian cycle in a graph, okay, or an Eulerian path in a graph if they exist, okay? And a similar story can be told for directed graphs, okay? Yeah? The complexity of the algorithm I described, if you do it in a naive way, might be to find a cycle might take order n time. And I'm going to do this at most n times and stick them together. That would be n squared. But if you know what you're doing and you're clever, you can do this in linear time. You want to do is to modify the naive algorithm to try to make sure you don't make a mistake. You want to walk la di da di da, but make sure you never take that killer step.
No, you can't take the killer step, but in this case, you will get to do the easy mistake. The algorithm converts such data to the easy mistake
with the cost price. Okay. Well, visiting an editor post twice is not the same thing that we're doing now. Okay, but there's another Eulerian math algorithm. It's the flavor that you want. Okay, which works in the following way. The problem that we would like to have, Alice's problem on this original graph, was that sometimes when you make a step, you can walk in a certain. If we had the original graph here, the complete graph on five vertices and that little tail, we could take this edge away. There's no problem. We could take this edge away, there's no problem. This edge, there's no way. This edge, there's no way. Here, right now, there's no problem so far. But here, we're going to be getting into a problem. Okay? Actually, is this where we can potentially make a problem? If I go up, up here, I still don't think I should make. Actually, wait, which way? Have I made it? Have a permanent problem yet? No, it looks like it's still okay. Let's go back and see if we can find where there was a problem. The real problem came actually, not when I had done this one, but I got that thing. Actually, no, I'm here. Have I yet made a permanent problem? Actually, at this point, I don't think I have a permanent problem. Like, do I have a permanent problem? Okay, I guess if I go to here, I go to here, okay? Actually, wait, why did I convince you before that I had a problem here? Yes?
Yeah, started out in the triangle.
Oh, I see. So you're saying that I start, my problem was that I had my K5 here. I started out walking here.
Walked around the outside.
Okay, I walked around here. I walked around here. I walked around here. Actually, and if I came in here, I was in trouble. Right? That was the problem I had. Okay? So is there a way I can tell that this edge was bad? There's an algorithm called Fourier's algorithm for Eulerian maps that will say, so long as I avoid walking across an edge whose deletion will disconnect the graph, I'm okay. Okay, an edge where you delete whose deletion will disconnect the graph is called a bridge. What happens if I delete this edge from my remaining graph? What happens? This edge has been separated from those edges, right? So long as I avoid taking that step across the bridge, because the bridge means I can go but not come back. Okay? If I keep track of where those disconnected edges are, I can then do a walk. So I don't step over a bridge until it's too late, until it's necessary. Okay? Then, in fact, that will also work. Okay? I find that the cycle algorithm easier to understand, but this will also work to find where Larry's patterns. Any questions? Can you check if it's an edge or a bridge? The answer is you can, if you're willing to spend enough time. Well, certainly you can do it in linear time. Why? Because you can delete the graph edge and see if it's connected. That would then give you an n squared algorithm. Okay? And I'm not 100% sure you can implement this in linear time. Okay, the other algorithm I know I can implement in linear time by being clever. Okay? But anyway, there's more that I wanted to say about the complexity of this. Okay, any questions? Okay? It should be clear now that we can solve Eulerian cycle problems efficiently, even though Hamiltonian cycle problems are hard. Okay, does everybody agree with that? Okay? Now, the question is there a way we can reduce our SBH problem from instead of being a Hamiltonian cycle problem to make it a Eulerian cycle problem? And there's a very nice way to do that, okay? We say that a de Bruijn graph of order k is a very, very special graph where the vertices represent strings, basically the graph we have seen so far, except that what we've got is the vertices are going to represent all k minus 1 all strings of length k minus 1, and the strings, the edges, are going to represent strings of length k. Okay, so let's think what we have. Our SBH experiment tells us what strings of length k are present in the data. We're going to construct a graph where the vertices are not corresponding to fragments on the actual probes, but corresponding to the probes minus one, either the left base or the right base. So all strings of length k minus 1 that are present in the k base, the strings of length k that answered yes. Is it easy to find what k minus 1 mers are present in the k mers that answered yes? Okay. What? At most two of them. It's a trivial matter. Okay. But in this graph, the vertices are length k minus 1. The edges are of length k. So the edges correspond to the actual probes. So what is nice about this graph? Okay, what makes this graph interesting?
what would a string that visited that contained every single throw and only those throws look like? I claim, since every edge here corresponds to a k-mer that is in the string, we want now a walk where we visit every edge in the graph, okay, exactly once, okay? And what problem is that? That is Eulerian cycle, okay? So does everybody see that in this very fancy graph, we have done the seemingly magical thing of reducing the Hamiltonian cycle problem to the Eulerian cycle problem? Okay, any questions? This is actually a very beautiful thing, so if you don't see the beauty, I'd like to explain it a little bit more. Okay? What's kind of neat here? The vertices correspond, the edges now correspond to k-mers. Okay? The vertices correspond to k-1 mers, which are not the experimental data, but extracted from the experimental data. The actual probes, each probe corresponds to an edge in this graph. Okay? When two edges, when you go from one vertex to another, you're traveling an edge, okay? What is in common between this edge? What is the string that this edge represents? TAA. What is the edge that this, this one's probably made right. What is the edge that this one represents? GCA. Okay? So, in fact, what we're going to do is we can build this graph. There's going to be one edge for every probe. Okay? Walking along two consecutive edges. Okay? We know that they've got to have a k-1 mer in common. Right? Okay? So if I have two probes in common, how did we come up with the adjacency information before? Before we had vertices of size k, and an edge between any pair that shared a k-1 mer in common. Now we know the possible consecutive edges have to share a k-1 mer in common. In fact, it's the exact same problem, okay? Only in a way that we know we can solve it. Any questions about that? Okay, so this is everything incredibly cute, okay, if you understand it. Okay? Yes? Well, in this particular case here, now if I ask for an Eulerian cycle of this graph, I have to visit every edge. I am forced to visit this edge. Visiting this edge gives me an AA followed by an A. So to get my AAA corresponding to that probe, I have to visit that edge. Okay? So I do get it. Okay? Any questions? Yeah. Where's the ambiguity? What's the exact same problem, but it's an easier way to solve it. So you're right, is there still ambiguity? It's the exact same problem, exact same data, so the answer is yes. If I ask you for the shortest possible sequence, well, there might be multiple such things. In principle, going around this loop a million times is consistent with my data. So you're right, I still have the ambiguity, but at least I have a way to analyze it and discuss it. Okay? Any questions? Okay? Yeah. Well, again, here I talk about in order to correspond to a sequence, I want an Eulerian path. The algorithms of Eulerian path are quite similar to Eulerian cycle. Okay? So there's no real difference there. Okay, yeah. This is a De Bruijn graph of order, three, yes. In fact, when people talk about the De Bruijn graph, it's a graph that you can construct just as a function where the vertices represent all strings on an alphabet as a function of the length of the strings and the size of your alphabet. In general, the De Bruijn graph is this, it's not really something from SPH. But the Bruijn graph is a string on a particular alphabet size of a particular order. The vertices are all the strings of length k minus 1 with the edges corresponding to all strings of length k.
And this graph has various interesting theoretical properties to it and stuff like that. Okay? Yes? Is it possible to get stuck in what way? Well, you can analyze whether a graph is Eulerian or not by just counting its degrees. So once you know whether or not, so for directed graphs, the condition for whether there's an Eulerian cycle is a little different. It means that the in degree of every vertex has to be the same as the out degree of every vertex. Okay? If you want to know, does this graph have an Eulerian cycle, we can check. Is this an Eulerian cycle? This is even in, same as out, yes. In, same as out. In this case, yes, because this is two ways. There's two going out, two going in. You have one going in, one going out. Here you have two going in, two going out. Okay? This vertex here, you have one going out, two going out, one, two, three going in. Which one is it? AC? AC here has three going out. Right. Two going in and three going out. So this, in fact, does not have an Eulerian cycle. But it has only two imbalanced vertices, right? That's why it has an Eulerian path. Okay? And so if you take a look and map our Eulerian path back to it, you'll see that it starts at one of these and ends at one of those. Okay? Yes. Well, I still don't know what it means to get stuck. Well, if this graph, remember, corresponds, this graph came from a sequence, right? How did we get this graph? We had an SVH array that told us what edges were present in that graph. If the chip did not lie to us, there was a sequence that gave rise to this, right? Therefore, at least that path will be an Eulerian path. So if you have a graph that comes from an array data where there's no mistakes, then yes, there has to be an Eulerian path in this graph. Okay? In general, does a graph have an Eulerian path? The answer is not necessarily. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So the final thing just to take away, because it seems like a paradox here. Why was I able to, Hamiltonian cycle is an incomplete problem, you can't solve it. Eulerian cycle is an easy problem, you can solve it. Why then can't you, don't you in general, take Hamiltonian cycle problems and turn them into Eulerian cycle problems? The answer is this is a very special graph, okay? That you can't pull this trick in general, okay? That the magic of the regularity, the structure of this graph has that magical property to it. Okay? And in general, that isn't the case. Okay? It's one of the things that makes this so pretty. Any questions? Okay? Good. So what have we shown? We have shown that it is impossible to take a SVH array. And we've shown that it's possible to, given the results from one of these arrays of all k-mers, figure out whether or not the sequence is unique. It's unique if there is only one path. Okay? To figure out, find and sometimes describe all sequence consistent with it. Any questions? Okay? Now the question is, we really want unique sequences. Okay? For one of these chips to really be useful for sequencing, we need to be able to reconstruct the sequence uniquely, meaning we want that graph to be very, very simple. And the question is, can we get a sense as to when we might expect that the sequence of a, that how long, given us a particular size array, what is the likelihood, or how long a sequence can we sequence such that with a good probability, we're not going to have any trouble. We saw that trouble corresponded to loops in the graph. Does everybody agree with that? So the question is, the density of the graph is a function of how long my sequence that I'm trying to sequence it is, and how many vertices my graph potentially has. Namely, how big is my K such that I'm constructing all K-mers. Okay? My first claim is that that if I have a sequence of length 4 to the K plus K, okay, and I want to sequence it on a chip, a probe, an array with 4 to the K probes, there is no hope for a unique reconstruction. Why is that? Because each probe is going to tell me a the presence or absence of a particular spray. If I have a spring that is longer than 4 to the K, there's going to have to be a repeated taper, okay, by the pigeonhole principle. Does everybody agree with that? So that gives us an upper bound on how much we can hope to reconstruct it. Okay? Can someone give me an example of the shortest spring of length K, sequence that I can't hope to reconstruct with an array of size 4 to the K? Array of all K-mers. What would be the sort of sequence that I can't hope to reconstruct uniquely? Yeah? A to the K. If I have A followed by K, you know, a sequence of length AK, that one probe lights up. I don't know if I have a string of length K or K plus 1, K plus 2, dot, dot, dot. But these are fairly broad bounds. It's very rare to give me a sequence of just that. And it's very, you know, I have to be incredibly lucky to sequence something where every probe lights up. What is the expected size of something I might sequence by SBH? Okay? Is anything that we've talked about so far in the analysis or on one of the homeworks maybe look like it might bear on this question? Okay? How long it is? What? Okay? Remember at one point we asked the question of what is the probability that a sequence is likely to be, you know, let's say, what is the length of a K-mer such that it's likely to always be present? And what is the length of a K-mer such that it's very unlikely to be present? Right? And we found something like that around log base 4 to the n is sort of the magic length, is sort of a transition, if you will. That a sequence that is much smaller than it, let's say half that length, is very likely to occur, right? And a sequence that is much greater than that, let's say 2 to the log of base 4 of n, is very unlikely to occur by chance. Okay, where did these numbers come from? How many k-mers are there in a sequence of length n? What's the maximum number of distinct k-mers that can occur in a sequence of length n? Okay, how many different sequences of length n can occur in a sequence of length n? Something like n minus k, right? Because the first one, it could be this is different from the one that starts in the second position, third position, fourth position. Basically, there's about n minus k different sequences. What? Okay, now for the reconstruction to be unique, these all better be distinct, right? Because what is it going to mean if there is a k-mer that is in common here? What is that going to mean in the graph? It means that there's going to be a vertex here where we got into that common sequence from someplace left, then came back and left again, right? This is what is trouble, right? This is what a cycle is, okay? So the operating thing is we want to make sure that our probe size is large enough that we don't expect the string to have a repeated instance of that. Does everybody sort of agree that that's what's driving it? Any questions? Okay? So how big a k-mer might we expect? Well, from simulations, you get the following kind of results. That if you have an array of all 8 MERS, with high probability you could about sequence 180, okay, before you start getting into trouble. And that had 64,000 probes on it. Today, Abimetrics was going to sell us an array with 500,000 probes on it. By using this, if we assume this kind of results, you might be able to sequence something of length about 500 bases or so. Okay? So in principle, we're now getting to about the size that corresponds to one of these gel reads. Yeah. It's sort of a little bit like the birthday paradox, which is that one, you know, it's sort of the moment that there is one repeated k-mer, you no longer have unique reconstruction. Okay? Does everybody see that? Okay? And that these are the results that you get. In principle, this shows that if the arrays get denser and denser, then eventually you're going to get to a point where you can hope to sequence longer fragments than you can with gels. Okay? Does everybody sort of see that? Now, where do these numbers come from? Well, these come from simulations. For me to try to analyze why this is, okay? Here in this last column, I show 4 to the k over 2. Okay? And if you look at it, 4 to the k over 2 is grossly corresponding to the fragment lengths that you can expect to uniquely sequence. What? Is the result for what? For? I'm sorry, not hearing. Birthday paradox. Okay? So this is basically from the result. This is just what arises from what is basically how long a sequence can we expect to have till we start having a repeated k-mer. Okay? And, you know, it starts to correspond to fairly well. Any questions about that? Okay? Any questions about that? Okay? Fair enough. Okay, so let's we'll continue a little bit with the theory of SPH next class and talk also about, start getting into some of the more bioinformatics questions of analyzing arrays, things like clustering and stuff like that. Any questions? Okay, thanks for your attention.